North Korea is not called the Hermit Kingdom for nothing. It's closed and secretive, a hard country to know. So the sight of Kim Jong-un, the supreme leader, contrite and in tears at a huge military rally in 2020, was taken as a sign that the regime and its leader were in trouble. Indeed, that things had reached the lowest point in the 77-year history of the Democratic People's Republic. But now, 5 or 6 years later, Kim is riding high. His internal position is assured. Money is flowing into the country from munition sales to Russia and, not negligibly, from cyber scams. Relations are stronger with China, sanctions are not so crippling, and his country is more belligerent than ever. For the current issue of the journal Foreign Affairs, Dr. Jung Park has written How North Korea Won, The Strange Triumph of Kim Jong-un. Dr. Park is an American historian and analyst. Her focus at the CIA and later at the US State Department has been North Korea. Her 2020 biography of the supreme leader is called Becoming Kim Jong-un. Dr. Park knows the kingdom and its leader, and she joins me now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much, David. Great to be here with you.
At that low point in 2020, North Korea was spoken of as the most sanctioned country in the world. What impact had sanctions had on the troubles of the country?
By 2020, when the pandemic hit, as we all remember, in early 2020, Kim was in a bad spot. He had walked away from very high-level summits with President Donald Trump at the time, and he had, at those summits, asked for the lifting of these sanctions, which in 2016 and 2017, that were signed on by China and Russia at the time, they banned exports of North Korean textiles, seafood, iron ore, coal, labor. And so the fact that Kim was focusing on lifting of these sanctions during the summits indicated that he really needed that to happen. And when it didn't, and the pandemic hit, lots of people on the outside saw this as a potential death knell for North Korea that was economically hobbled by these sanctions and had a deteriorating, horrible health infrastructure and a malnourished population. So things did not look great for North Korea in early 2020.
Nor for the supreme leader. He had been in power at that point for, 9 years? And he was only a young man with no experience, political or military experience, when he came to power.
That's right. His grooming process was very truncated because his father, Kim Jong-il, had a stroke in 2008. And he died in 2010. So when Kim Jong-un came to power, he was in his late 20s, but his father made sure to shower him with all sorts of accoutrements of power, including titles. Like he became a four-star general when he was in his late 20s without having any known military experience. So at least the regime recognized that Kim Jong-un needed to have those titles, at least, and those medals to show that he was worthy of succeeding his father. And so by the time the pandemic hit, most leaders in the world did not have experience dealing with such a crisis of epic proportions. And Kim, of course, just 9 years into his rule, still very young at the time, of this very closed society, that it was unclear whether he would make it out at the other end.
Now, why were those sanctions imposed on North Korea? What were they intended to do?
Yes, sanctions have been imposed on North Korea for several decades, and those were designed to constrain North Korea's ability to generate revenue that they could use to build weapons of mass destruction. They were building ballistic missiles. They were testing ballistic missiles. They had, and under Kim Jong-un, North Korea has tested 6 nuclear weapons. The last one in 2017 was bigger than Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so the sanctions were in place with a UN Security Council monitoring system to ensure that we were choking all avenues of revenue generation for the regime.
But they weren't working. Indeed, it looks as though Kim Jong-un in 2020, at that very low point, was banking on the fact that the country had continued to test and perfect nuclear weapons and intercontinental missiles. Instead of sort of disarming, Kim had made the country deliberately more dangerous.
That's right. During the pandemic, he tested more weapon systems and new sophisticated weapons than he had before the pandemic. He made sure to continue to focus his priority on weapons development because that was the only way in his mind and in the regime's mind and his father's mind and his grandfather's mind that nuclear weapons were the only things that were going to keep the regime intact and that this particular Kim family line was going to be the ruling family. So, you know, I think it goes to show you that even during the pandemic, instead of looking for vaccines, which the U.S., you know, I was in the State Department at the time, the U.S. offered vaccines as the U.S. offered vaccines to lots of countries. The regime rejected all of those offers. He almost certainly was getting pandemic assistance from China. Now, Beijing was, of course, very concerned about regime stability, as it always is, and was making sure that that the regime was stable by ensuring that the goods kept flowing as much as they could flow.
So they breached sanctions. China was willing to breach the sanctions that it had signed up to.
Yes. And I'll note that Beijing and Moscow had signed on to all of these sanctions up until a couple of years ago. So in 2020, for example, at the peak of the fear of the pandemic, in the U.S. had noted that there were over 550 instances of Chinese flagships going to North Korea and over 30 instances of fuel smuggling. And so it was clear that that things were moving between the two countries.
But you also note that North Korea was making a huge amount of money with cyber scams.
That's right. This is one of the places where Kim took a crisis and made it an opportunity. Because everybody was online, because people were working from home, that created an expanded attack surface for North Korea. And North Korea has been doing pretty well. They're a very sophisticated cyber actor. And North Korea was able to generate potentially billions of U.S. dollars in revenue from these hacking. When I was in the government, we had noted and took efforts to really crack down on North Korean IT workers who were getting legitimate jobs through legitimate platforms and using those jobs to generate revenue for themselves and for the regime, but also using that as a way, as a backdoor to steal intellectual property or to steal money from the companies that they were actually working for.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm speaking to Dr. Jung Park, historian, former CIA officer, about the resurgence of Kim Jong-un and North Korea over the last few years. Jung, I had not realized until I read your article the extent to which China has been working for a long time to restrain North Korea, and that China has a huge investment in the Korean Peninsula being peaceful.
That's right. China and North Korea share a very long border. And Beijing has always been worried about that corner of China. It's been poorer. It's a poorer population. And the borders are very porous. And they became very porous, especially during the 1990s when North Korea was suffering from a devastating famine. So there was a lot of trade along the border. And Beijing has always been concerned about stability on its border and that at times China would try to show North Korea that it was willing to use economic tools to show its displeasure. Now, Beijing has to make sure, though, that that the economic pressure is not so much that it's going to topple the regime or weaken the regime. And so the Beijing has been much more restrained in its kind of coercive acts toward North Korea, because stability is such a big focus for Chinese leaders.
But then along comes the war in Ukraine, and that, on your argument, has proved a bonanza for North Korea.
It has been an absolute bonanza for North Korea. Kim and his father and his grandfather before him, they've always tried to balance their relationships. But over the years, because of the sanctions, because of North Korea's weapons of mass destruction program, North Koreans have been much more isolated. Former trade partners have gone away. Japan used to be a trade partner. South Korea used to be a trade partner. India used to be a trade partner. There are other trading partners. But as a result of the nuclear weapons program, North Korea's biggest trading partner is China. Over 95% of trade, North Korea's trade is with China. So that makes them incredibly dependent on China's goodwill. And what Putin's entry into the scene does, and the comprehensive strategic partnership does, is that Kim has many more levers to play against China and potentially against Russia. And so the Russia relationship has really proved a bonanza for North Korea in terms of the strategic leverage, as well as the revenue that Kim is getting from weapon sales with Russia. And third, Kim is now getting, or has been getting now 4 years into the war, that war experience that North Koreans had not had since the 1950s. They're learning about how their missiles are performing on the battlefield. Their soldiers are learning how to use advanced weaponry. They're getting better at drone warfare. Ukrainian intelligence and defense officials have said that that North Koreans were kind of bumbling their way through in the beginning, but now that they've learned quite a bit since the war has progressed. So that is extremely concerning as North Korea gets more professional experience and actually, you know, and free advertising for the weapons that Russia is using against Ukraine.
So North Korea is earning all of this cash, getting itself battle ready. And what are the weapons that it is sold to Russia? Are those sales on such a scale that it's leaving North Korea itself short of munitions?
Right. That's an excellent point because North Korea is selling so many munitions, artillery, ballistic missiles to Russia. Their factories are continuing to churn this out for Russia's war against Ukraine. But it does also leave them, you know, with fewer artillery for them to use in other bad ways. And so that's what one trade-off that that Kim is probably calculating in the near term. He sees that as an acceptable trade-off.
But he is saber-rattling with South Korea more than ever.
That's right. He has called South Korea North Korea's principal enemy. He has jettisoned his grandfather's and his father's policy of eventual reunification with South Korea. They've blown up monuments and infrastructure that were built during this inter-Korean rapprochement kind of days, but also just symbols of Koreans as one entity. I'll also add that he has called this de facto maritime boundary in the Yellow Sea null and void, which is concerning because there have been incursions over the decades across that maritime border, which could lead to miscalculation on both sides and could lead to a wider conflict.
Is the line across the Yellow Sea a sort of a gaming line, or are there real resources at stake here?
There are real resources at stake. This is not a big part of the world that we're talking about. So when we're talking about this de facto maritime border in the Yellow Sea, for your listeners, Pyongyang and Seoul are only about 35 miles apart. For many people in the United States and living in Australia and living in major cities, that's the length of a commute to work. And so this is not a big parcel of land or this expanse of land. And the Yellow Sea is the maritime border. It's very close to major industrial centers, major ports, major airports, and major cities in South Korea. So, and the Yellow Sea is rich in marine resources as well. So we're talking about real things here, and we're not talking about this big expanse of land or theoretical conflict. But this is, you know, the proximity and the closeness of the resources plus the major ports and cities. It makes it a flashpoint for potential conflict that could have devastating consequences.
What do you think of the man himself, Kim Jong-un? Is he clever? Has he learned? Is he capable of leading the country for any length of time?
I think he has done a tremendous job. Your listeners may recall that when he first came to power as a young 20-something-year-old, 27-year-old, there was a lot of poo-pooing about his abilities at the time. No experience, very truncated succession. He also did not look, you know, the way he looked and the way he presented himself did not make him seem like somebody who could take over this country as a 27-year-old.
No, he looked absurd.
Yes. But, you know, I remember there were lots of people who thought there's no way that he could last. And I was at the CIA at the time. Lots of outside voices thinking, the world is way too complicated for a 27-year-old who looks as funny as he does with potential health problems, like his father had these health problems, and that he would not be able to wield the levers of power. And his father may not have thought that either, because when we look back at the early years, Kim Jong-un was surrounded by people that, you know, these elder statesmen whom his father had trusted. But what Kim did as soon as he gained power was he started pruning the family tree. He killed his uncle by marriage, who was considered inside and outside the country as the number two, or maybe the real power behind the scenes. A few years later, he assassinated his half-brother in Malaysia, using these two unsuspecting women who rubbed chemical nerve agents into his face. So these are spectacular things that, you know, could be made into a movie. You know, so, sorry to say that this is all real. And he has improved his weapons. He has now more sophisticated weapons. He has more powerful nuclear bombs. He's testing underwater unmanned vehicles. He's testing drones. He has tested hypersonic glide vehicles. And so all of this, collection of weapons and that are sophisticated, more accurate, it makes him a very dangerous person. Add on to that, David, the fact that he thinks that he has much more leverage with his two very powerful neighbors, Russia and China, who are giving him economic and military support, he's in a better situation than anybody could have ever imagined back in 2011.
Do you back the intelligence conclusion that he now has an intercontinental ballistic missile that can deliver nuclear payloads to targets in North America?
That's his plan. And theoretically, he has the weapons to be able to do that. He has promised that he's going to have weapons that are going to fly 15,000 miles. And, you know, it's not just against the United States. 15,000 miles, he can hit anywhere in the world. And so this is not just a U.S. problem, and it's not just South Korea's problem or Japan's problem or Australia's problem. This is a global problem that as I argue in the piece, that China and Russia should actually be worried about.
So he's not a provincial player anymore.
Absolutely not a provincial player. The fact that he is intervening in a war in Europe and that he is developing these missiles that can hit anywhere in the world, and the fact that cyber attacks, they're not constrained by territory. Cyber attacks are against friend and foe alike. So this is absolutely a global issue that all countries, whether in the Pacific or Africa or Latin America or Southeast Asia, should all be concerned about.
Jung, thanks for joining us on the show.
David, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I've been talking to Dr. Jung Park, historian, former CIA officer, and officer with the U.S. State Department. Excellent piece in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine about the resurgent power and authority of Kim Jong-un, supreme leader of North Korea. And her book on the supreme leader, Becoming Kim Jong-un, is available. Thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.